You're with us as we talk about pocketbook issues this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Tax season is coming to a close, but the IRS is gearing up its operations. Last week, it issued its annual so-called Dirty Dozen tax scams, focusing on aggressive phishing scams related to coronavirus tax relief and economic stimulus payments. Has someone tried to steal your personal information? What happened? Are you already thinking about next year's tax returns? What do you want to know from a personal finance expert? How are you trying to lower your tax burden? We're at 800-642-1234. Sharon Epperson is a senior personal finance correspondent for CNBC. Sharon, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. So the deadline to file federal tax returns was a week ago today. How often do people not meet that deadline and seek an extension?
Well, I think there are many people that are struggling, particularly if they owe money to pay their tax and are concerned that they don't want to pay their taxes or they can't at this time, so they're not going to file. The problem with that is if you do not file on time and for every length of time that you wait, you are going to incur penalties and interest. And the penalties for not filing are substantial. So the IRS is really urging people to go to irs.gov/payments and try to figure out some type of payment plan so that you can pay what you owe when you're able to. And there are many different ways to do that so that people should not feel that they're not going to file because they owe tax and they don't have that money. The IRS will want your money eventually, but will work with you until you're able to pay it.
Yeah. What does that extension allow you to do?
So the extension that you file for is to extend the filing of a tax return until October 15th. It is not an extension to pay your taxes. So you need to put, if you can, contribute any money to any tax that you owe as soon as possible. That is the best thing to do. But the extension is for an extension to file that tax return because you don't have all the documents you need. You can't find all the tax documents that you need to file, and you need to wait until October 15th to do that. You have until that date.
How significant are the potential penalties?
They can be up to 25% of, you know, what you may have to owe, or they can be substantial. And the good news is that if you are filing, if you filed at the last minute last week and you were due a refund, let's talk about a happy situation, you could get interest on that. And I actually had never heard of this before, but it is law that if you are due a refund and it comes after April 15th, then you are to get interest on that money. And so you could get up to 5% interest on some of that refund that you are due if it comes, you know, now after you've filed your tax return at the last minute.
I've never heard that. Has that been longstanding or is that something new?
Well, I think the issue is most people file by April 15th and get their money. You know, they want to get their money by that time. I think now, because we had the extension already to July 15th, the change in terms of the deadline, that law did not change. And so they're now having to pay interest on the refunds. And it's up to 5% interest until June 30th. If you got your refund already by June 30th, you get 5% interest. And then until September 30th, it's 3% interest. So it does change quarterly. But that's something I don't think very many people knew. And the one thing to say, though, that is the interest on your refund is also taxable. They get you every which way.
But
at least you get something.
Sharon, I was one of those last minute filers this year.
And I was too, Kate. I was too.
Well, that makes me feel better. But I noticed that the withdrawal from my bank account from the IRS happened just very quickly. It felt like almost immediately. How quickly is the IRS processing returns, processing refunds?
That's very interesting to hear because they've also been hit with a backlog where there were millions and millions of envelopes and documents waiting in trailers at the IRS to go through. And so, I think the priority is going to be on making sure that tax returns are processed as quickly as possible. And e-filing certainly helps that. And majority of tax returns that were filed were done electronically. The IRS traditionally says it takes about 3 weeks to get a refund. In this environment, it may take perhaps a bit longer. It's interesting that they already processed your check.
Well, I'm sure that the Fed's like, I need that money. I'll take that money.
Yeah. And again, it depends on how you do that too. Sure. How are you paying? Are you paying? Also, are you paying an electronic check? Are you paying a paper check? Are you doing it on your credit card? So that can have an impact as well.
Talking with Sharon Epperson, senior personal finance correspondent for CNBC. We're spending the hour on pocketbook issues and the financial strain of the pandemic with your questions. After last week's tax deadline, what questions do you have about refunds, extensions, audits? Join in 800-642-1234. Sharon, how does the audit process work?
Well, let's put it this way. If someone calls you and says you're being audited by the IRS, if someone sends you an email and says you're being audited by the IRS, if someone sends you some message on social media and says you're being audited by the IRS, it's a scam. The IRS will contact you with a letter saying that something is awry and they believe that you owe a certain amount or some part of your tax return there was some discrepancy, and they will put that in the regular mail and send you a letter about it. So that's how it starts. It starts with a letter from the IRS telling you what the discrepancy is.
Who is most likely to be audited? Because we've heard that audits are quite rare.
Well, I think a lot of it has to do with making sure that you have proper documentation, particularly for itemized deductions. And if you have a very high number of deductions compared to what the IRS may think you should have based on your income, that may be a red flag. There are also just simple mistakes, I think, sometimes that people may make in terms of information that is put in incorrectly, whether it's a social security number, whether it's information about dependents or something like that, that could also potentially trigger. The other issue that has come up with some folks is when you're getting self-employment income, are you keeping track of all of those 1099s? Are you keeping track of all of the money that comes in and making sure that you are putting that on your tax return? And if you miss one because you're like, that wasn't a lot of money, the IRS gets that document too. So you need to make sure that it matches up. So self-employment income is another can be another issue if it's not documented properly.
How long should you keep receipts?
Well, I mean, banks and financial institutions will tell you various things about how long you should keep receipts. But I think a general rule of thumb is around 7 years to keep that information. I know for a lot of folks, that's just more and more paper in your home that you may not keep track of, or maybe you don't have that fantastic Excel spreadsheet filing system on your laptop. But if you can keep those documents, it is very helpful. And I just kind of put them in a big envelope and put the date on it and tuck it away on a shelf. And thankfully, I haven't had to open those envelopes. But
let it collect some dust.
Exactly.
We have CNBC's senior personal finance correspondent Sharon Epperson answering questions this hour. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill are negotiating the next coronavirus relief aid legislation. Would you support Congress approving another stimulus package? What would be your top priorities? Who needs support? How would you suggest stimulus checks be dispersed? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email personal finance questions to ideas@WPR.org. We'll be back in a minute with Sharon Epperson right here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're spending the hour on money issues that hit home. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The additional $600 a week federal unemployment benefit in the CARES Act comes to an end this month. And meanwhile, Congress is working on new relief to counter the pandemic's devastation. The Senate has 16 days to debate, negotiate, and pass another stimulus before their August 7th recess. Should Congress approve another round of stimulus checks? What was your reaction to the first round of payments? Were the checks an important boost for the economy or misguided spending by the federal government? Join in 800-642-1234. We have CNBC's senior personal finance correspondent, Sharon Epperson, who stays with us. Well, let's take a call now. Dan is joining us from Coloma. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning. What's your question?
Question is, we save our records for 7 years, and then we go to pull them out after five or whatever, and the ink on the receipts is, like, evaporated while it was in storage.
Ah, your receipts are disintegrating. So, Sharon, what would you suggest when Dan goes back 5 years and those receipts, you can't read them?
Well, I think that what you want to make sure that you're doing is if you can see it a little bit, try to write it in or something like that. I think that the good news is unless you are filing a claim for a loss from some type of securities that you had, investments that you had that really tanked, or you have some type of deduction that's a bad deduction, you may not need it for the full 7 years. Most of the records, the IRS is actually saying you should have kept for 3 years from the date that you filed your original return, or 2 years from the date that you paid the tax, whichever is later. And that's if you're trying to file a claim for a credit or a refund after you file your return. So, for instance, if you've decided now that you realize that some of the things that you could have written off, you hadn't written off, you need to have those records for 3 years.
Dan, does that make sense?
That makes sense to me. I have a second question with that, too. You know, they audit you back how many years. Do they go by the year that you filed as the tax laws change? So are they auditing and then they go, okay, now back in, back in 17, this is what we had. Do they follow that year's tax law? I mean, if we would keep a catalog of that, we'd have a basement full of files.
Yeah, that's a good point. There have been a lot of tax law changes, and particularly this year with the pandemic, there were a lot of things that have changed. And yes, I do believe that the IRS will be following the law of that tax year, whatever is. And I will say it sometimes to some people may seem overwhelming, but it really is laid out clearly on IRS.gov. What based on the publications that they have for whatever type of issue you're talking about, what kind of deduction you're talking about. If you go to that publication for that tax year, it will tell you what you can, for instance, write off or claim as a deduction. So I would urge you for whatever the specifics are that you're trying to look up and make sure what the law was regarding that you go to IRS.gov.
Dan, thanks. We're talking with Sharon Epperson, a senior personal finance correspondent for CNBC. We're exploring a range of money issues that hit home amid the pandemic. Let's bring in Sean now, joining us from Sussex. Hi, Sean.
Hi. How are you? Thanks for taking my call. This actually issue is relevant to me because I have used a software program, TurboTax, in the past to file my taxes. This year, I used a system called eFile, and because of it, it wasn't clear to me that I was paying taxes that I owed the government. So I owed the government $700. I paid on the 15th of April or July, and subsequently discovered that I had paid twice. So the government got two separate payments of $700, which I can't really afford. And I've been on to the IRS several times to see about getting the second one voided. And it wasn't clear to me, like, how exactly this would be done. And I'm just wondering, has anybody ever had that experience? And is it just obvious that the IRS will return your money promptly?
Sean, thank you. Well, Sharon, yeah, what about that circumstance?
Wow, overpaying the IRS. No one wants to do that, right? I think that you're doing the right thing in terms of contacting the IRS to find out if you are or when you are going to be able to get that money returned to you. If you have, in fact, overpaid, I don't think you're alone in having this happen, particularly as people try to figure out the right software systems to use and use different software systems. But I do think that as you're trying to correct these issues, it's important to make sure that you get the IRS to return that excess money to you as a refund. It may take it takes a good amount of time to get those refunds processed when there's an issue like this. So I don't know that it would happen in the 3 weeks time that most refunds are supposed to come. But you should continue to contact the IRS and write to them and to make sure that you do get that rectified for the overpayment that you made.
I would imagine, too, Sharon, to document every single step of the way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Documenting every step of the way.
Let's bring in David now in Mondovi. Hi, David.
Hello.
Hi. Yes.
Hi.
What's your question?
I know you're talking about a second round of stimulus package. I haven't received anything from the first one yet, and I've been on the website trying to log in to track where my check would be and have had no luck, been locked out, waited 24 hours, tried again. Just looking for, are they still sending out checks yet, or is there anything, any place I can go? There's no phone number on the site or anything, so not sure what to do here.
I think you're doing the right thing in terms of going to the site and checking the status and going back every 24 hours, because as they'll tell you, they only refresh it every 24 hours. Unfortunately, you are not alone, and there are taxpayers out there and people who are due stimulus checks that have not received them yet. They're not, you know, the numbers are smaller, the government says, than you'd like to think, but there are definitely people that are out there. A couple of things to check are just to make sure that you do fulfill all of the eligibility requirements, and that there's nothing, you know, awry there in terms of you being eligible to receive the payment, and also to just make sure that your tax return that they're basing it on is in, and that you filled out everything that you can. But I think going in and continuing to check to see where that payment is important. And the other issue, because many people in Congress have talked about their constituents having issues getting their checks, is to perhaps write to your representatives as well and let them know that you're one of those people that in your particular area has not yet received your first stimulus check.
David, I'm wondering, too, do you file jointly, may I ask, with your taxes?
No.
Okay. All right. Well, good luck. Thank you for calling in. And, you know, we're talking here about that second round of relief, Sharon. You know, we've heard Majority Leader Mitch McConnell give details of an emerging plan roughly costing $1 trillion. Democrats are pressing for $3 trillion. What is on the table for the next relief package?
Well, there's a lot on the table and not much consensus between the Democrats and Republicans, other than we know people are hurting and we want to help. But the specifics of that can be pretty wide. One of the Democrats are really pushing to make sure that people who did not receive stimulus checks were not eligible for them. Immigrants, people with dependents who are 17 years old or older are able to get stimulus checks. There's a push to make sure that the $1,200 check is reinstituted again on another round. Republicans are saying perhaps that is too much. Maybe we should lower the income level for those who are eligible, to make sure it really targets low income families and individuals. So there's still a great deal that needs to be ironed out before, as you said, July 31st the end of the month, because a lot of people are also very concerned about at the end of the month not being able to get the federal unemployment benefits of $600. So that's another issue that we're they're grappling with in this next round of stimulus.
Do we know yet whether Congress would extend the extra $600 a week in unemployment benefits that would be expiring? What is the status of it?
We don't know yet whether or not that's going to be extended. And again, if everything is not fully completed by July 31st, then there's going to be a lapse, even if it comes back. So that's still very much up in the air and still being worked out. And I think many members of Congress want to make sure that this gets done by next Friday. But on CNBC yesterday, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy said that it's more likely it would be, you know, something perhaps in the first week of August when they're working this out.
We're looking at the effects of the pandemic on family budgets. Sharon Epperson is senior personal finance correspondent at CNBC. Working parents may find themselves at a tipping point with finances as schools decide whether to open this fall for in-person learning and caregivers juggle childcare. Are you laid off, furloughed, or thinking of pulling out of the workforce? Are you juggling how to pay bills? What questions do you have about prioritizing what gets paid now? Do you have retirement on the horizon? How are you feeling? Join in 800-642-1234. We'll be back with Sharon Epperson after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're looking at pocketbook issues here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Retiring now could be unpredictable as the number of COVID-19 pandemic infections soar. Businesses may close down again, send markets reeling, or vaccine news could improve conditions. So what do you want to know about withdrawing your savings during a market downturn? Have you considered delaying retirement by a year or two, maybe more? Pew Research says about 4 in 10 workers have access to an employer-sponsored retirement plan or one through a union. Those plans, of course, are tied to the stock market. How is your 401k performing? Do you check it now? Join in 800-642-1234. We have Sharon Epperson, senior personal finance correspondent at CNBC. She stays with us this hour. So, Sharon, since it might be affecting retirement plans, how is Wall Street reacting to the up and down, the day in and day out of this pandemic crisis?
Well, I think some people who are concerned about their job security or have been laid off or furloughed might be wondering, what are folks on Wall Street seeing that we're not seeing? Because the recovery that we've seen in the stock market has been pretty significant. And yes, it's been early on very topsy-turvy, but it is we've seen a strong market recovery. And that means that's good news. If you do have money in your 401k and you're watching that and it's remain pretty steady or grown a bit in the past couple of months. And so you want to make sure that continues. And I think the hardest part of personal finance is discipline. And that is especially true when it comes to retirement savings. If you're far away from retirement in particular, and you're just looking at what is happening in terms of the job market and in terms of layoffs and unemployment, you just want to make sure you have that cash cushion and that you're secure. And so I think some people may be pulling back a bit on their contributions just to make sure that they have that emergency savings. And that's not necessarily a bad idea. You do want to make sure that you have sufficient emergency savings, but you also want to take advantage of the opportunity to invest for the long term at a time when the market is doing pretty well, but also at a time when you are going to have a long road for growth, so that even if there is some turmoil, that you have time to for that recovery to take place and you're consistently contributing to your retirement plan. So there's a lot to consider. And a couple other things, Kate, that I would raise is that if your company offers a matching contribution or your employer offers a matching contribution, you absolutely should be taking full advantage of contributing to that retirement plan, at least enough to get that matching contribution and that free money from your employer. And it's particularly important to do that right now because many employers are doing away with that matching contribution and in a way to not have to have the layoffs perhaps that they need to have and the restructuring. The one way they're restructuring is with your retirement plan.
Some families, though, are in such financial straits, need to dip into that 401k or that retirement plan. What type of penalties happen when you do that?
So the CARES Act has given, and the legislation that is part of the stimulus package that was passed at the end of March, it does provide you the opportunity to take a loan or withdraw from your 401k plan and not face the same penalties that were there previously. So you would not have a 10% early withdrawal penalty if you're taking a withdrawal from your 401k for a coronavirus related reason. And that would be you or a spouse has had COVID-19, you've been laid off or furloughed, or your spouse has due to COVID-19, something related to. So basically, everyone in this country has been impacted by the pandemic in some way, but being able to document that is going to be important to make sure that you can take this this withdrawal without facing that 10% early withdrawal penalty. And you would be able to take up to $100,000 out of your 401k and make that withdrawal. The other thing that you could possibly do is take a loan against your 401k, and again up to $100,000 if your employer allows that is what you could do. The issue there is that if there is any concern about your job security, you will, if you leave the company, have to pay that money back pretty quickly. And so that's taking a gamble that you were going to be in a situation that you'd be able to pay that money back. So those are things to consider. But I would say, Kate, before you dip into your retirement fund, again, that is the biggest amount of money that many people have. And so that's the first thing that you think about. Whatever the issues are that you're dealing with where you're unable to pay, whether it's a credit card bill or a utility bill or your rent or your mortgage or student loans, look at what relief may already be available. In the CARES Act, again, you have until September 30th before you have to pay back federal student loans. You can take a pause there. You can take a pause perhaps with your mortgage. You could take a pause maybe with your rent, depending on what your landlord is working out. And you certainly should call every creditor and let them know your situation and see, can I not pay this month? Can you waive the interest? I will pay, you know, X amount next month to make sure that I'm trying to stay current on my bills. This is the time to have a conversation with your creditors and lenders and not to hide.
And certainly, too, I think what you're saying is sort through the relief that has come so far to make sure you understand what you're eligible for.
Exactly. Exactly. There's a great deal of relief from you know, as I said, with housing, with student loans, that some people don't realize. And I think it's important to kind of sort through that and see what's available to you and ask.
Is this a time to modify your 401k plan or your stock investments due to the pandemic?
I think this is a time to look at everything, to look at your finances holistically and see where you stand. And so when you say modify, that would depend on a lot of things for a lot of different people, but it is important to now take a look what's in it. You know, there are many people who say, yeah, I contribute regularly to my 401k, but they're not sure how much actually they're contributing regularly. They're not sure what mutual funds, what investments are in that 401k. They're not sure if they're making enough to get the company's matching contribution. So these are all things that you need to be looking at right now and take the time to see what's there and take the time to go on your company's website, figure out what the number is that you can call to if you have any questions, and ask the questions. Get the information that you need to know where you stand. The hardest thing, Kate, in terms of moving forward or even getting a foothold on where you are now is to just know where you stand, to understand what you have, what you own, and what you owe. That's just the basics of financial planning, but it's something that now that many of us are at home, we're stuck at home, we have time to unfortunately think, worry, be anxious, be stressed, but let's also be proactive. Let's also take this time to be proactive and figure out where we are and what we have and what we owe and talk to those people who may be able to give us a little bit of a reprieve or help us figure out how we're going to be able to make sure we pay what we owe, we get out of debt, and how we can grow our money too in our retirement plan and our other investments.
We're talking with Sharon Epperson, senior personal finance correspondent at CNBC, asking about a range of money issues amid the pandemic. With your questions as well, what do you think about the federal government giving relief packages, bailouts? Is it important to prop up struggling industries during an economic crisis? How is your small business doing? And what small businesses do you think need assistance? We're at 800-642-1234. Sharon, if Congress approves another round of stimulus checks to people, how would you suggest they spend that? Say it's $1,200 if they have been furloughed or if they are jobless. How do you divide up that amount?
Well, I think the first thing is to make sure that you are able to keep a roof over your head and feed yourself and your family. So the necessities is of course, going to take precedent. But anything that's not a necessity, that money should not go toward that. This is not, you know, there have to be other ways that you find a silver lining in the fact that you did get a stimulus check without using it for something that is not a necessity. And at this time, if you can save any of that money, absolutely you should do that. If you need to pay off a certain debt that, again, you're going to get perhaps a reprieve for a short amount of time, but eventually you're going to have to pay that, then that money should be earmarked there. But I think it's a great idea to get in the habit of putting your money in buckets. And so that $1,200, perhaps you think of it, of splitting it into three pieces, and that one piece is going to be for the necessities because you have been laid off, furloughed. You got to make sure that you are able to pay for the daily necessities. The other third is for the debt that you have incurred, and you want to start paying that down and come up with a regular plan to do that. And the other third, you're going to try to save. And it might sound crazy that, you know, you're telling me to save a third of a $1,200 check and I need every penny, but it's the discipline of it. So maybe a third is way too much, but some portion of that should be money that you do not touch, just so that you can get in the habit of not touching every penny that comes in the door.
Are there any types of savings accounts that you particularly like? Or if you are starting to save, how do you stash away that money?
Absolutely. Look for a high yield savings account, and high yield, unfortunately, doesn't mean a whole lot. It's not like you're going to get a 5% return on your savings account, but you could get more than 1% or a couple percentage points interest on a savings account. And most of those accounts that have the highest interest would be online accounts. You want to make sure that they're insured. Accounts that are insured by the federal government, FDIC insured. And if you go to a website like bankrate.com or depositaccounts.com, and even look at on CNBC.com, of course, for some of the stories that we've done on the best savings accounts, that will give you a good guide as to where you can think about putting your money.
Talking about the crisis hitting family finances with CNBC's senior personal finance correspondent Sharon Epperson, what do you think would help close America's racial wealth gap? What steps should our political leaders take? What needs to happen in schools, businesses, other places? Why do you think our racial wealth gap persists? We're going to talk about that. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Sharon Epperson here on the Ideas Network. Let's get back to our conversation now with CNBC senior personal finance correspondent Sharon Epperson. We're talking about pocketbook issues this hour and the growing wealth gap between America's richest and poorer families. Sharon, you've been reporting on the racial wealth gap. How do you measure this gap?
Well, there are numerous studies that measure the wealth gap as it applies to overall wealth, to wages, to housing. And one of the most recent studies and widely cited is from McKinsey and Company, looking at how much Black Americans versus white Americans are expected to earn over their lifetime. And it is likely that the medium white family would have more than 10 times the wealth of the medium Black family at this time. And when you're looking at those levels of wealth, looking at $171,000 for the median wealth for white families versus $17,000 for Black families, $20,000 for Latino families, it's a very, very wide gap. And so there are a number of studies from McKinsey, from the Economic Policy Institute, that are looking at these gaps and the issues of education and job training and also wages that are really contributing to this.
How much does homeownership, real estate, contribute to this gap?
Homeownership is a major part as well. And one of the things that, you know, Americans overall are looking at is as the idea of homeownership as the road to wealth, when in reality, many people, their homes are owned by whatever bank holds their mortgage. And so I think it's very, it's an issue that is very important to look at. But I think when you look at the greatest asset that most Americans have is their income, and that wide disparity in income and in earnings is also a major, major part of the wealth gap.
Do we know how the pandemic is affecting this gap that's existed for years, well before the coronavirus arrived?
Well, I think it's exacerbating the gap. If you just look at the unemployment data and look at the numbers of Blacks and Latinos that are unemployed and have been laid off and furloughed during this time compared to white Americans, compared to the overall unemployment rate, I think that tells a large story about what is happening in terms of people being able to generate the income that they had previously, which was already at a wide gap, and now not having any income at all.
What steps can we take to close this gap? How do we remedy this?
Well, we have a series that we're doing on cnbc.com/investinyou called Grow Together. And I don't think this is a problem or an issue that can be handled by one group. It's an American problem. And one of the key issues is to start at the very beginning, which is with educating ourselves about finance. And the financial literacy gap is very, very wide as well. And when you look at the number of states that require personal finance as a course before you can graduate from college, it's nowhere near 50 states. And so we need to increase that number and make sure that students are required to take at least one semester of personal finance to kind of before they enter the world. And right now it's only 1 in 6 U.S. high school students that are required to take that semester of personal finance for high school graduation. And the numbers are even worse when you're looking at students from low-income schools, you know, students from schools that have a very, very high percentage of free or reduced price lunches. They're not getting that. So at this time, when we are, again, home, remote learning, more online education, this is a time to seek resources like the Council for Economic Education, Next Gen Personal Finance, Khan Academy, places where you can go, as well as the government's website, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's Money As You Grow website, and the National Endowment for Financial Education, another nonprofit. They have a lot of information there about finance and your personal finances and fun games and quizzes. And, you know, for those parents who are looking for just like some other activity, please give me some other activity for my child to do during this time. Those are places to go, and engaging videos, and you're going to put them in front of the laptop or the iPad or your phone or some screen anyway. Do it with one of these websites and have them learn something at the same time. So I think that's one place to start.
Sharon, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a great day.
You too. Sharon Epperson, Senior Personal Finance Correspondent for CNBC. And now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the story about a Wisconsin musician whose fan base has grown globally.
Rapper and songwriter Ted Park grew up in Madison and got his start recording songs on his dad's laptop in South Korea. Now, the 25-year-old is living in New York City and has tens of thousands of fans around the world. WPR's Eric Lorenzen recently talked with Park about his Wisconsin roots and his journey to the bigger stages.
Hip-hop is just so emotional. The hunger, the story, the power. If I were to record myself saying something and, like, saying my message, like, that's how I wanted to do it. My name's Ted Park. I'm 25 years old, and I'm from Madison, Wisconsin. I make music.
DJ Payne 1. Yeah, I've been lit, acting a fool. That's a bad bit, need about two. I want a Rari, let it go zoom. Drop on the top, hide in the coupe. Yeah, I've been lit.
I feel like I got a little bit of something for everyone. You know, I got ballads.
Girl, you used to call me when I used to be your man. I wanted to say sorry.
I got more turn-up stuff. If you're trying to have fun.
I put in my ears, I got so much to prove. From Wisconsin, now my pockets got that big cheese. Pull up in that six speed. She like that I'm risky. No friend of
mine. But I think the most important thing is that I have my own flavor, my own sound. I have my own voice. And it's very authentic and honest to me.
Now, I never changed my number, hit my phone. Now, hello, I don't know who is this. Hello, I don't know who is this.
Hey, it's been a minute, how you doing, what you on? I just flew into the county, promised I'd come back around. That's just me saying, like, no matter where I am in life, you know, how far I go, like, I'll always have Madison in my heart. Growing up in Madison, like, it was very calm for me. Played a lot of sports, studied a lot, read a lot of books. And then I feel like when I went to Korea, like, my whole life just, like, flipped. 13 years old, man. Like, I'm leaving my friends behind, my life behind, and I was not really proud to be Asian at that time. Imagining myself, like, living in Korea with a bunch of other Korean people, like, I hated that, man. I started just trying to rap. I was, like, just, like, going through, like, my parents' stuff, and I found a little webcam microphone, and I plugged it in to my dad's laptop, and I downloaded the Swagger Like Us instrumental. That was the first beat I rapped on. You know, for me to go to Korea, for my life to, like, totally disintegrate, I wouldn't have discovered music. I got to get in touch with my roots. I actually became kind of proud to be an Asian person. I come back to Madison for high school. I was like, I'm gonna be a rapper. Everyone was like, nah. I was like, you know what? I'm staying committed regardless of what anyone says. And I'm gonna stunt on these haters later, you know. I dropped out and I went to New York City.
Hello, I don't know who is this. Hello, I don't know. Hey, it's me.
2016, so 4 years ago, me and my big brother DJ Payne 1 put out Hello, Who Is This? We definitely never knew that was gonna be like my launching song. We go viral on Spotify. Pretty much every record label hits me up. And I think that was the first time seeing some sort of independent success. I just kept putting music out. Just did a North American tour. LA headline show 3 weeks ago. It's been crazy. I'll say I'm from Wisconsin. And people be like, oh man, cows, cheese, Milwaukee Bucks, Packers. I'm like, yeah. When I hear Wisconsin, I think Blue Mendota. I think family. And I think peace of mind. It used to be love-hate. Because I was like, how come my city won't fully get behind me? My career blossomed outside of Madison. But my relationship with Madison doesn't have to be music and business. Because it's home. And I'm proud of where I'm from. I'm proud of being that small-town kid, this Asian-American kid from Madison, Wisconsin, that is somehow blowing up right now.
I don't know who is this. I don't save no numbers.
That was rapper and songwriter Ted Park, who grew up in Madison and now has fans around the world. He's been releasing a new song every Tuesday, which you can find on his Instagram. WPR's Eric Lorenzen talked with him earlier this year. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.